Amen. Thank you, Joe. Good morning, everyone. Welcome to our Bible class. So I came down with a bit of a cold. Started with my wife, went to my daughter, and now it's mine. And so bear with me, please. I apologize for any harshness you hear coming through the microphone here. Two things a cold does for us. One, it reminds us of how amazing our bodies are, that they're able to fight off these microscopic invaders that if they had their way would do us in. But God has set our bodies up in such a way to be able to fight them off. The other thing it does is keeps us from taking for granted being well. Anytime we have a measure of health, it is a blessing beyond our recognition to be healthy and well. We aren't always that way, but when we are, we take it for granted. Being sick, having struggles, remind us of the blessing it is to be well. I don't mean to pretend like my cold's that bad, but just a little perspective there that maybe is worthwhile. I remember it would have been about the Christmas break of 2004, maybe three. I was in a class called The Philosophy of the Creation-Evolution Debate with Ralph Gilmore. And I remember distinctly this slide appearing in his work. He had a little class book, and this slide was in there. And he was talking about what he called the barriers that atheism has to climb, has to get over somehow. If you want to be an atheist, and that's your worldview, there are some challenging, insurmountable, you might suspect, barriers that you have to get over. Number one, you have to go from something. You have to go to something from nothing. So in other words, you start with absolutely nothing, exactly nothing, and then something results. How do you get over that barrier? In the second place, once you have something, you have to go from non-living, disorganized matter to life that's self-replicating, to life that can accomplish purposes, can live and move and do things. You have to go to life from non-life. And then finally, you have to explain on atheism, with no direction, no design, no deliberate intention, you have to explain complex life from simple life. That's where we are today. We're going to study that last part as we think about the atheist's response to teleology. In the third place there, we have to understand or explain on atheism how you can go from simple life, say single-celled life, to complex life that's able to get up in front of a microphone, even though it's sick, and talk about itself. We have to think about complex life, animals, and ecosystems, and all of these things have to somehow be explained. The question then that we come to, and the question that Ralph Gilmore came to in that class was, is it possible for anyone to get through these three barriers that are barriers not for Christianity, not for theism, but for an atheistic worldview? Is it possible? In that third line, we see the idea of evolution. Now, that's an undefined term, and we need to say what we mean by it. But again, I want to remind us, we said last time that evolution is, in my mind, the answer of atheism to design. That is, it's what's put forth by atheists to explain complex life, arrangement that's required to produce life and to make life possible. That is what the role that evolution plays, the theory of evolution. Okay. So as we jump into this, we want to say a lot about the theory. We want to define it, put it in perspective, and then look at how it supposedly works, okay, to have some idea of how things progress under the theory. But before we get to that, I want to look at a brief bit of perspective, and this is biblical perspective, on the idea of evolution. I want to make a quick point before we get into some of the details. Go in your mind, if you will, back to the very beginning, when Adam and Eve are the only living human beings on the planet. The only living human beings on the planet. There are two of them. They lived in the garden with God. They knew God. They talked to God. God walked with Adam and Eve in the garden. And so It's certainly the case that for Adam and Eve, it would have been literally impossible to deny the existence of God. And we made this point at the very end of class last week, but I want to come back to it for just a minute. For Adam and Eve, it would have been literally impossible to not believe in God. In other words, to be an atheist. That would have been an unsustainable, absolutely absurd position because of their intimate relationship with God there at the beginning. And then I go to the next generation, and I think about the children of Adam and Eve. Abel, while he was still living, Cain and Seth and others, who were children of Adam and Eve, they could not have, it seems to me, possibly denied the existence of God. Why not? Well, because their parents had direct contact and interaction with God. And so any conversation about God between, say, Cain and Abel and Adam or Eve, any conversation about God would have involved clear and certain statements about who God was, about his existence, and so forth. It would have been not even in the realm of possibility to consider denying that God was who he said he was, that God was active and living. The same, it seems to me, would have been true of the grandchildren of Adam and Eve. Most of us are old enough to remember something like the events of 9/11. And we can, when we talk about those things, we talk about them from memory. Some of us are old enough to have some memories of the Second World War and going back into something like almost 100 years. Some of us maybe have talked to people, and I think about these things a lot, and maybe it's not worth my time, but some of us may have talked to people who were alive during the time of the Civil War, okay, going back to the end of the 1800s and 1860s. These events of history cannot be denied by anyone. So some of us are younger than the events of 2001 with the bombings by terrorists in New York and so forth. And so we don't remember that from direct experience, but we can talk to people who have direct memories of those events. Likewise, we can talk to people who have direct memories of the events of World War II and other major historical events. In the same way, it seems to me, the grandchildren of Adam and Eve, even if they didn't have direct communication with God, and how exactly God diminished that direct communication, I don't know. But those grandchildren of Adam and Eve still had access to their grandparents and so could have talked about and would have talked about God and his existence. And so for the grandchildren, it seems to me, it would have been literally impossible to be an atheist. In Genesis chapter 4 and verse 26, there's an interesting passage that says, "Then men began to call upon the name of the Lord." I wonder if something had happened up to that point where there had been some distance that existed now between Adam and Eve and God's interaction with Adam and Eve and the people who were then living, so that maybe they had gotten far away from God. They had removed themselves from the knowledge of God, and then there was a turning point where they decided now to again call upon or come back to the name of the Lord. In Genesis chapter 6, it doesn't take long for mankind to fall very far from God, very far from relationship with him. Had people even by that point began to doubt the existence of God? I don't know. We do know that their thoughts were only evil continually and so forth. And so it's interesting for us to think about. What's the point? For a while, atheism was impossible. But there had to come a time whenever for the first time, individuals started doubting the existence of God. And I would submit that as soon as people start doubting the existence of God, they begin looking for something like the theory of evolution. They begin looking for some explanation of how I could be here, how life could be here, without intention, without design. That's just a guess or a theory. It could be totally wrong, but it's something for us to consider. So let's look a little bit at some history. Charles Darwin is typically credited with the discovery of the theory of evolution, but this is not at all the case. It's known to be false among even mainstream historians that it's not the case that Charles Darwin discovered the theory. The theory is much, much older than that. Exactly how old, we don't know. There's a man by the name of Titus Lucretius Carus who died in the 50s BC. He was a Roman. He said in poetic form the following: "Wherefore, again, how merited is that adopted name of earth, the mother, since she herself begat the human race, and at one well-nigh fixed time brought forth each beast that ranges raving round about upon the mighty mountains, and all birds, aerial, with many a winged shape." And he said that in a poem called On the Nature of Things. He goes on, in the same poem, "And in the ages, after monsters died, perforce there perished many a stock, unable by propagation to force a progeny. For whatsoever creatures thou beholdest, breathing the breath of life, the same have been, even from their earliest age, preserved alive by cunning, or by valor, or at least by speed of foot or wing." That's the idea of natural selection right there, by the way. They are preserved by cunning, valor, or speed of foot or wing. And many a stock remaineth yet because of use to man. It goes on. And so is the idea fully formed here in 50s BC? No, certainly not. But the idea is there. These words are full of the notion that there is a persistence of certain creatures who have an amount of strength, a certain amount of fitness, we would say in modern terminology. But that's in the 50s BC. We can go back even further than that. So in the 400s BC, a man named Empedocles from Sicily talked about various forms appearing in nature. Some of those forms would die off, become extinct, and go away. And the ones who were strong or fit or efficient at gathering food or competing in whatever way were the ones who persisted. So some species would appear and then die off, and others would persist. And this is certainly a precursor, and it's recognized to be a precursor of the modern notion of natural selection. Even earlier than that, a man named Anaximander, and he is credited with, at least in terms of historical accounts, with being the first one to say anything that looks like what we call the theory of evolution. Anaximander died in the 540s BC, and a historian of science and technology, Brian Bunch, in book History of Science and Technology, Brian Bunch is his name, he says, Anaximander formulated a theory on the origin and evolution of life. He believed that life originated in the sea from the moist element, and that's a translation of Anaximander's words. A moist element was the source of life, which was evaporated by the sun. The presence of shells and marine fossils was for him the proof that the sea covered much of the earth's surface. He postulated that humans must have originated in the sea and have originally resembled fish. This is in the year something like 500s, the 6th century BC. Thousands of years, literally, before the time of Charles Darwin, who is credited with these ideas. Now, it's certainly true that Charles Darwin is the modern face of the theory of evolution. The current theory of evolution is called the Neo-Darwinian synthesis, which obviously bears his name and is based on substantially on his ideas. Charles Darwin, in the 1830s, traveled across the world. He took a world tour as a naturalist interested in studying various plants and animals. He collected specimens along with his crew. He was on the HMS Beagle as he traveled around the world with a crew of something like 100 people, and he collected, as part of that expedition, various samples and specimens of various kinds of life. In the 1850s, he wrote a book called On the Origin of Species by Means of Natural Selection. That's only part of the title, but that's the idea. It goes by Origin of Species, and he published that book, and it became instantly sensational hit, and of course can still be purchased today. There were many other naturalists, British naturalists in particular, who influenced Charles Darwin. It's not the case that he originated the idea. He took the idea to prominence, you might say, but the ideas were floating around in his time significantly. He was not the one who came up with the idea. He was the one who kind of brought things to a head, you might say, in particular with his trip around the world and his comparative anatomy from the specimens that he collected. Others who influenced him include Charles Lyell, Lamarck, Huxley, Thomas Huxley. His grandfather's name was Erasmus Darwin, who had many of the same ideas that Darwin eventually published. And those are among Erasmus's writings. And so you can see, and we should recognize that there are many who influenced Charles Darwin in the writing that eventually materialized. There is a book called The Darwin Myth that if you're interested in these things further, I'd encourage you to read. It addresses the many myths that have surrounded Charles Darwin, his life, and his work, and it is certainly a good use of your time, I think, to read and look through, if you are so inclined. So what is the theory? I'm going to give my opinion about the theory, and then we're going to get into the details. And I'm giving my opinion so we can make a point here at the beginning. The point is, the right response to the theory of evolution is a calm, informed answer. Okay, the right response is a calm, informed answer. Not ignoring it, not hiding from the question, not avoiding it. Rather, we should know something about it and try to respond as kindly and as helpfully as we can. The theory of evolution is anti-intellectual in the sense that it does not tolerate questioning. And we've talked about this in this class before. The theory of evolution does not tolerate questioning. If you raise questions in public forums about how it can be that some aspect of the theory of evolution is correct or is true, you will be many times shot down given the cold shoulder or whatever you want to call it. The theory of evolution does not invite questioning. It cannot be doubted without there being some consequences for expressing doubt. And so it is the sort of thing that has attained a status that puts it beyond questioning. It's not allowed to be questioned, and you know something of this yourself, I'm sure. Secondly, the theory of evolution is irrational. What do we mean by that? Well, several things. For one thing, a major tenet of the theory is natural selection. Natural selection is the idea that essentially the fittest members of a species are the survivors. So we call that survival of the fittest. But if you think about what that is saying, and you start to ask, how do you define survival? Well, I know what survival means. That means the organism has lived to, let's say, the age of reproducibility, so it's able to reproduce. But what do you mean by fittest? What is the fittest organism among a group of organisms? Well, the definition of fit that's used by biologists all over the world is the ones that survive. And so if you think about that, at least on one level, survival of the fittest can be stated as the ones that survive are the ones that survive. The fittest are defined to be the ones that survive, and so there really is no explanation. There are tautologies all over the place, and we use them all the time. A tautology is, for example, a bachelor is a married man, or six is equal to six. These are tautologies, things that are evidently, we're just talking about identity. And matters of definition. It is, on some level, a matter of definition to say that the fittest members of a species survive. We're just saying that the survivors are the ones that survive. So it is irrational, and we'll say more about that. But it's also irrational because it does not bear up to scrutiny. So if we start to do something like put numbers to the theory of evolution, we run into problems right away. One scientist asked the question, how many morphological changes would be required to go from a whale like mammal, a whale-like mammal, breathes oxygen, okay, has to come up to the surface for air, and then submerges again. A whale-like sea-bound creature, how many morphological changes for that to become something like a land-bound mammal, something like, let's say, a raccoon? How many morphological changes to go from a whale to something that can now breathe with lungs in the standard way on land? How many changes? Can you give me a number? Would it be 100 changes? Would it be 1,000? Would it be 50,000? Would it be 100,000 morphological changes that have to take place to go from a whale-like mammal to a ground-based, land-based mammal? No one will touch that question. They won't even address the question because the answer is staggering. The number of changes required for such a transition is staggering. And so it does not bear up to scrutiny. Again, I'm not supporting any of these claims. I'm just making them. But I'll say now, the theory is irrational. Third, the theory of evolution is very popular. Now, I want to make a quick point here about what's in parentheses there, the idea of being publicly bold. People who are proponents of the theory are publicly very bold. I'm not so sure that they are as bold in private. That is, when we talk with our friends, and we're more open and honest about the questions that we actually have and the issues that we actually deal with, when we're not on a stage and saying what we think we ought to be saying, things sound a little bit different. And I believe that's the case for many, not all, but for many proponents of the theory. They are publicly bold, but privately harbor many more questions than they let on. But nonetheless, the theory is certainly popular. We should remember, though, that popularity is not an argument. No matter how popular something is, that does not make it true. It does nothing by way of arguing for the truth or falseness of a proposition. Something can be very, very popular, and it can be at the same time either true or false. And that's something we need to remember. In particular, those of us who are parents of young children need to remember that just because something's popular does not make an argument. Many times our children will run into popular notions, popular ideas that are false. And so somehow we have to prepare them to address that incongruity or apparent incongruity, that something can be popular and at the same time false. How do we do that? I don't know. But we need to work toward that end. And finally, the theory of evolution is, again, this is my opinion, but it is a fairy tale. It's a fairy tale for adults that does not even begin to explain what it sets out to explain, the progression of the addition of tremendous amounts of complex functional information into the DNA to enable an organism to live and survive. It is a fairy tale. Nevertheless, we cannot ignore the theory of evolution. We cannot pretend like it doesn't exist. We cannot go on our merry way and just hold to our faith and pretend like it's not influencing us at all. At the very least, we're obligated, from a perspective of defending our faith, to know something about it. Not to know everything about it. We'll never know everything about the theory because it's constantly changing and we can't dedicate all of our time and resources to learning about any single topic. But we should be as informed as we can to be able to give an informed answer. In the next place, the theory is very vaguely defined. If you think about the term itself, evolution simply means change. At least that's what it meant before the 1850s. Evolution means simply change. Lots of things evolve. Language evolves over time. That is to say, language changes. Times change, people change, and so forth. And so the fact that change is constant seems to lend some implicit credence to the correctness of the theory of evolution. Well, if everything else changes, surely it's true that life changes. Okay, so we have to be careful about the terms that we're using. When we look a little closer, new dogs are bred. So if we mix different kinds of dogs, Their offspring will often have new characteristics that take some combination of their parents. New plants are developed that have greater yields, for example, in agriculture. Is this an example of evolution? Well, it's certainly an example of change. Is this an example of evolution? What about antibiotic resistance? What about pesticide resistance? All of these things involve changes in the genome of organisms. In case of antibiotics, we're talking about bacteria. In case of pesticides, we're talking about in the genomes and DNA of insects. All of these things involve change. Is that evolution? Is that what you mean by evolution? So we need some kind of a definition. By evolution, we must mean, and this is what people typically mean when they talk about the theory of evolution, the undirected process by which all living things, the undirected process, every word here is important, the undirected process by which all living things are thought to have developed and diversified from the first living thing. A shorter version of this comes from Merriam-Webster, descent with modification from pre-existing species. So descent has to do with offspring, okay, with variation among the offspring, and then consequent selection, and then modification to produce new species from existing species. So it's an undirected process by which all living things developed from the first living things. Now, a small note here that's important is there at the bottom. The theory of evolution presupposes the existence of simple life, and it makes no effort whatsoever to explain how non-life produced life. And that's an important thing to keep in mind in conversations with people as we find ourselves in them. Evolution does not explain or even try to explain how we went from molecules to, say, the first single cellular life. It makes no attempt to do that. It only says that once life exists and is reproducing, that there's some differential reproducing so that we get variation, and then from that selection, natural selection can be made. But there is no explanation here on that second barrier that we mentioned at the beginning of non-life producing life. So evolution is an undirected process by which all things supposedly came about. I want to focus, though, the rest of our time today on the mechanisms of evolution. What is the mechanism? And I think you can see the, I can't see it in my printout here, but you can see behind me the highlighted text toward the top there. The mechanism of evolution is essentially selection acting on variation. That is natural selection acting on random variations that appear in species. And so let's understand both of these terms just a little bit. In the first place, and again, this is the modern perspective, Darwin would have said something slightly different because Darwin lived before the discovery of DNA. So we're going to update what Darwin would have said to modern times. In modern times, we say that a mutation occurs in the DNA of a reproductive cell as the DNA is being copied. And so we've talked already about how we have this string of DNA letters that represent the alphabet that gives the code on which all of life is based, in which all of life is written. And as that DNA is necessarily copied for cell division to occur, as that DNA is copied, there is an error in copying. Now remember, this is an error that is undirected, unintentional, unintelligent, random, as random can be, a random copying error is made. Now, in the DNA copying of human beings, there is on average one error made, one letter change error made for every 10 billion base pairs or every 10 billion letters that are copied. There is a single error, one out of 10 billion on average. And so this is a highly accurate process of copying, but occasionally there are errors and mistakes in mutations. Now remember, every cell has in the human genome has something like 3.1 billion base pairs, and so on average, in three cellular transcriptions, you would have roughly one error. for every 3 cells reproduced. But a mutation occurs in the DNA of a reproductive cell, okay? Now, if I have a mutation in my finger, that's not going to affect reproduction. Okay, so we have to have a mutation in a reproductive cell. Secondly, the new organism then has a variant set of DNA. Okay, so a new organism has this mutation or this error, this copying error in its DNA. Now that DNA is the instructions on which that organism will be built, and so it will be built differently. Okay, you have the original DNA, the copied DNA with an error somewhere, let's say, and now that copied and that error-prone copy of DNA will be used by the organism to build the parts of the organism. If the variant then, evolution says, if the variant is beneficial, if it's better in some way, if that error happens to give a benefit to the new organism, it will be selected in the sense that it survives to produce offspring. Okay, it will survive, it will maybe be better at gathering food, or maybe it will be better at fighting off predators, or maybe it will be better in competition in some other way, and it will then be selected just by the environment, not by any intelligent selection, but it will be selected by the rigors of the environment. Okay, so let's illustrate this briefly, and we'll give 2 quick examples. This is evolution in the ideal. Okay, this is the kind of story that you hear in Evolution 101 at university or in high school, wherever you may be. This is the kind of story that's told. And this is off the top of my head. You could think of a better example, and there are countless examples of similar things, of just so stories that explain how evolution takes place. For example, imagine an eagle, and the claws of the eagle are under consideration. In, say, a nest of eagles, there is a variation in the size of the claws. Some are a little bit longer, some are a little bit shorter among the offspring, and so this is just something of a variation, right? How do you explain the variation? Well, to explain the variation, you've got to go back to the DNA, because the DNA is what built the organism in the first place. But let's leave that aside. Let's just say there is variation, and some claws are longer than others. The larger clawed birds, then, we can reasonably understand, would be maybe more often likely to capture and grasp and hold on to their prey as they swoop down and grab it, and they can hang on to it better with that better claw. I should have said talon, right? Sorry, I'm noticing that just now. So they grasp their prey better than others. On average, then, they more often are the ones who survive to reproduce because they have better access to food, and so they're better able to survive. Well, the ones that survive are the ones who will be reproducing. And so their offspring, the story goes, will then have a larger claws themselves, and so that larger claw characteristic will become predominant, especially if there's competition for food. Okay, if there's limited resources available and lots of eagles live in a particular area, the ones who are best at getting food will get the food, and then the other ones will be left out hungry and less, therefore, able to reproduce. Okay, and so there will be competition for limited resources. The ones with the advantage, the survival advantage, will be the ones who are more likely to reproduce. What does that mean? That means, on average, in the long run, talons get larger because these are the successful animals. That's the ideal. There are hundreds of stories like this. This was not a picture drawn by Charles Darwin, although it's a part of the myth of Charles Darwin that he studied finches in the Galapagos Islands. He did not. Those weren't studied. These drawings weren't made for another more than 100 years after his trip on the HMS Beagle. But this is a related story to the one we just looked at. Okay, in the 70s, some scientists kind of took the same trip that Charles Darwin did, or tried to reproduce it as closely as they could, and they noticed these finches, okay, these birds that they called finches at least. And they noticed that on different islands, different birds had various size beaks. And they also noticed that the beaks that were larger were better able to crack a certain kind of nut. And so because they were better able to crack that nut, they had better access to food, they were better able, therefore, to survive to the age of reproducibility or reproduction, and then they did reproduce, and they reproduced finches with large beaks as well, and so that that propagated that characteristic. Okay, that's the story. That's the story, is that there's variation, and the variations that are a little bit better do better and then propagate their kind. Now let's look at this story through a more realistic lens. So I want to take a minute and talk about what you might call evolution in reality. So we have to build a couple of things up here, but we'll see in a minute that things are not nearly so clean and neat as the analogies tend to make them look. What are the fundamental things that we understand? First of all, we understand that all an organism has to work with, all that an organism is contained in its DNA instructions. Now, I'm not talking about the soul of man, okay? I'm leaving that as a separate issue. But from a physical perspective, the physical body of an organism depends entirely on the instructions in its DNA. Nothing happens in the human body that hasn't been specified in the instructions, or in the body of any organism for that matter. Secondly, once the animal is born or hatched, that organism, with its particular set of instructions, its particular way of building itself, is plopped into an environment. Now, the environment has temperature. It may be hotter or colder. The environment has a certain availability of food source, okay? If you happen to live in a part of the ocean where there are lots of plankton all the time, well, then food isn't so much of a concern for you. But if you happen to be an organism born into a desert, let's say, then food is a major issue. So there are many, many dimensions that an organism has to deal with when it enters the environment with its particular set of instructions. And so it enters the environment and it has its tools, you might say, contained in its DNA. Now, the organism will either survive to reproduce or it will not. And there will be all kinds of lucky accidents and unlucky accidents. That is, you could possibly have a very fit organism plop into the environment and accidentally get run over by a bus. Okay, where that could be any number of things, right? An unlucky accident. Say a very strong variation of a particular species accidentally, for whatever reason, does not reach the age at which it could reproduce and pass on its strong characteristics. Or you could have a very weak organism that is lucky in some way, okay? But we're not interested in those extreme cases. We're interested in the reasonable, on the average, on the whole sort of scenario. So the organism is plopped into its environment, and it either survives or it does not. Now, the mutation that may come in the offspring is entirely, and we've already said this, but it's important to focus your mind on it. There is no intelligence, no direction, no guidance, no deliberation, no intention whatsoever going into the mutation. So you have a highly accurate system of copying DNA, and every once in a while at an unpredictable location, there may be some copy error. Now, there could be a point mutation where a single letter is changed. There could be a snip of DNA that's inserted into a certain position in the DNA. But all of these things are entirely heartless, senseless, undirected, and random. Okay, so mutation, any change, is entirely random. Finally, then, in reality, we recognize that fitness has many dimensions. There's fitness along an element of strength. There's fitness along an element of ability to gather food. Fitness along the ability to ward off predators or attract mates or whatever any of these things might be. These occur along many, many thousands of dimensions. There are then two fundamental problems that we have to think about as we think about natural selection, this idea of variation and then selection by the environment. There are two fundamental problems. First of all, we cannot generate new useful variations in the way that we've just described. We cannot generate useful variations by randomly making a mistake in some copying process. That is not adequate to even begin to produce something that's useful. Much more often than not, what will happen is something that works will be broken by that kind of an error. And we'll say more about that later on. Furthermore, whatever variation appears has to fit in with a well-coordinated, already existing organism. That is, you have an organism with all of these systems already in place, and whatever change you introduced has to be compatible with those existing systems. You can't just reinvent the wheel without awareness of all of these other systems that exist in the organism. This reminds me, and we were almost out of time, so we'll end here, but this reminds me of a time when I had a car that started using oil. Do you ever have that happen? It burns oil. And what do? You throw it away. Unless you're poor. You try to fix it, right? So I decided to try to fix it. So in the process of fixing it, I took the old water pump off. Well, so there's a whole story here. So it involved taking the engine out and putting a new engine in. But in the process of putting the engine back together, I bought a cheap aftermarket water pump, which pumps water through the engine to help keep it cool. So I bought this old water pump that I was going to bolt onto the side of the engine. It was $20 or $30, very cheap. Okay, very cheap. And so I was excited about that, much less than the one I should have bought. And it fit perfectly. It had four holes on it for bolts that would go right onto the side of the engine. It had a pulley right in the middle where the tying belt would run over. It had the right diameter pulley. It matched up perfectly to the engine block. It had on the inside a propeller that would kick as the tying belt turned it. It would kick the water through the engine the way it's supposed to. It had little holes on the inside where it touched the block where the water would shoot through the engine. Everything was perfect. It was designed just right for the engine except for one thing. The inlet pipe on the back of the water pump was too small in diameter by about an eighth of an inch. It was too small, so I couldn't get it to go on the inlet pipe where the cold water came into the pump. It would not go on. It was too small. It wasn't even close. I could have hit it with a hammer. I could have smacked it. I could have done everything. It would never go in that hole. I would estimate that something like, and I've tried to count, 30 or 40 variables had to be exactly right on that water pump. Even though it didn't work, 30 or 40 of its variables were lined up just right so that it would be functional on my car. But that one problem, that one error in manufacturing, okay, this single diameter would have destroyed my engine if I had just put it together in the way that I was trying to. It would not have worked. It would not have worked. It wouldn't have even been close. The engine would have been catastrophically destroyed beyond repair. And so that's an illustration, I think, at least in my mind, of the kind of issues you deal with when you talk about coordinating with an already complex system. If you make a change in a complex system, much more often than not, you introduce problems. All right, thank you very much for your attention. We'll pick up here, carry on next week.